KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
I live in East Oakland in the depths.
In the Piedmont Avenue neighborhood.
I live in the Sheffield Village.
I live in Pittsburgh.
I live in Oakland.
Coming up, repairs have begun at San Francisco's Transbay Transit Center, but we still don't know when it will reopen.
Bus riders are paying extra for a transit center that they can't even use.
Then an East Oakland mom takes her kids to an event in Marin, and it doesn't go so well.
There were a bunch of rules that were spoken and unspoken, and I could not decipher what the rules were.
And a man who's been in prison for 28 years finds out if he got parole.
From the countenance on his face, it seemed like it might have been positive.
You'll find out today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. San Francisco's Transbay Transit Center turned 6 months old today. It's a huge bus station and planned high-speed rail station. And if you remember, it was a pretty big deal when it opened, especially when people saw that long rooftop park. 6 weeks later, workers found cracks in the building's structure. It's been closed ever since, and repairs have only just begun. KALW's transportation reporter Eli Wertschafter joins me to explain what went wrong and what's next. Hey, Eli.
Hey, Hannah. So you remember that day when we visited the transit center right before it opened?
I do. That was 6 months ago?
That was 6 months ago already.
Huh.
I thought maybe we could just play some of the tape from that day to jog our memories a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You can see Mission Street right there. Lots of cars going by. And the cars are going under the new Transbay Transit Center.
Yeah.
It's three blocks long. It's got this kind of like lacy siding. Lacy metal siding. How
very
would you
describe stylish.
It? It's stylish. It feels stylish.
I remember that. And it was new, you know, shiny brand new. People had a lot of hope that it would be this awesome new transit hub. But since then, the transit center has barely been open, quite a disappointment.
Yeah.
So I know it closed because there were some cracks in the building, but can you recap for us, first of all, how were the cracks even discovered?
Okay, so it was in September, about 6 weeks after the transit center opened. A couple of workers were going about their business, installing some roofing tiles, and they noticed a 2-foot-long crack in a steel beam over Fremont Street.
Mm.
So officials shut down the transit center that very afternoon, and then later that night, they discovered a smaller crack in another beam over Fremont.
Okay, so does anyone know why those cracks formed?
After the cracks were found, the mayors of San Francisco and Oakland both wrote to the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, which is a Bay Area-wide agency, and the mayors asked the MTC to investigate what went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So the MTC went to work, hired a bunch of experts, and came out with some preliminary findings in December. And what they found is that some of the steel in the building was too brittle,
mm-hmm.
and that the way it was welded together caused it to crack.
Mm.
Now, what's incredible to me is that the whole building went through more than 21,000 inspections.
21,000 inspections?
Yes. I mean, not individual things, but you can imagine different checklists.
Right. Okay.
And all the specific spots where the cracks formed were inspected and were all approved.
And it wasn't caught. Right.
Right.
Wow.
They just missed this. It didn't look like it would be a problem.
Mm-hmm. So that was all that went wrong? Just brittle steel and bad welding?
Well, that's kind of the micro level view. You could also look at the big picture of why this whole project was so challenging. The transit center spans three blocks,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's got streets running under it. So you can think of the transit center as being built something like a house of cards. Structurally, there are these triangles on the ground supporting a flat layer on top. And the gaps in the triangles, that's where the streets run through. And on top of those triangles where the supports meet, that's holding a lot of weight, the rooftop garden, the bus deck, everything. Just like in a house of cards. And that's where the cracks in the building started.
So you're saying this is like a house of cards and it could just fall like a house of cards?
Well, I don't want to take the metaphor too far. You know, the building was designed to withstand an 8.0 earthquake. So it's got redundancies built into it so that if one part fails, it doesn't just collapse
mm-hmm.
like a house of cards. Obviously, it's still standing.
Right.
And, you know, the Transbay Joint Powers Authority, that's the government group that runs the building, they say the building is very safe and that they only closed it out of, quote, an abundance of caution, unquote.
And is it fixable?
I hope so. And they seem to think it will be fixable.
Uh-huh.
The MTC, along with their analysis of what went wrong, came up with a plan of how to fix the building, or really to reinforce the broken beams. Instead of repairing those beams, they're kind of sandwiching them with metal plates to hold it together and bear the load.
Okay, so when will the transit center reopen?
Hannah, I'm sorry to say we still do not know. Workers only just started doing reinforcement work on the building a week and a half ago.
That's recent.
That's recent. Mm. And they don't expect to be done until the first week of June, mm-hmm. about 4 months from now. And after that comes another round of inspections and certifications before the building can reopen again. So no one is saying yet when that will be.
But why is it taking so long?
Well, you have to remember this whole project took 20 years to plan and build. Right? These monster projects just take an incredibly long time. And in this case, after the cracks were found, it took a couple months to figure out what went wrong and to come up with a repair plan. Mm-hmm. And then a few more weeks to get contractors for a plan, a few more weeks to actually start working. Then you build for a couple months. Before you know it, it's the summer. Mm-hmm. I mean, considering we were waiting 20 years for the building to open in the first place, maybe a few more months won't feel so long in retrospect.
So let's talk money. Does anyone know how much all these repairs will cost?
We don't have final numbers yet, but the important thing to know is that the building is actually under warranty for 2 years. The various contractors and subcontractors who built it will have to pay for the repairs. So taxpayers don't have to pay for that directly. But the Transbay bus riders are paying with their time, mm-hmm. since it takes about 15 minutes longer to get into the city compared to if they have that terminal. And they're also paying with their money.
How are they paying with their money?
So for bus riders who take AC Transit to cross the bridge, in January, they got a fare hike of $1 each way. Mm. And one of the reasons was to help pay for the new transit center, because it makes it faster for buses to get into the city. And that fare hike was planned long before the transit center opened and then shut down. But now, of course, those bus riders are paying extra for a transit center that they can't even use.
Oh, that doesn't make sense.
You know, once those fare hikes go into place, I guess AC Transit didn't want to delay them further. Mm. And for the transit center, you know, the whole time it's closed, it's not taking in any revenue. Mm-hmm. And it still has surprisingly high operating costs, even though it's closed. The Transbay Authority cut back the operating budget by 27%, but that means they're still spending about $1.5 million each month.
And where's that money going?
Even with the building closed, they're doing a lot of maintenance and janitorial work just to keep the building in shape. The Transbay Authority pays for insurance. They pay mm-hmm. for security for the building, various other contracts they went into before it closed that they say they can't back out of now. They're taking care of the rooftop park. Gardeners are actually still going up to the roof every couple of days
really?
To tend up to all the plants. Yeah, uh-huh. Those plants don't care whether anyone's there or not.
Yeah,
actually,
nope.
Apparently the plants are quite happy without as many visitors. You know, when people initially visited, there was a lot of foot traffic over the lawn. Now, according to the Transbay Authority, the garden is in better shape than ever.
And the rain.
And there's plenty of rain.
Right.
Anyway, all these ongoing costs add up to $1.5 million a month.
So are these costs covered by the warranty that you talked about earlier?
Well, the warranty is for the repair costs. But a spokesperson for the Transbay Authority told me that they plan to charge the contractors for all the costs of shutting the terminal down. That includes lost revenue and costs like the investigation into what went wrong, which is expected to be more than $1 million. But let's say the contractors refuse to pay for that and they go to court and win. Then the public could end up holding the bag.
Okay, well, I did not get to see that park.
You did not? Me neither.
I didn't, but hopefully it'll open soon. All right, thanks, Eli. Eli Wirtschafter is KALW's transportation reporter. You can reach him at transportation@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Playwright Lisa Rothman is an East Oakland mom. One day she took her kids to a winter solstice carnival in Marin, and things were never the same. She encountered moms in yoga pants keeping very close tabs on their kids. She encountered a fire-breathing dragon and just an overall attitude that neither she nor her kids understood. In her one-woman fantasy comedy play called Dragon in the Drop-Off Lane, Rothman compares parenting styles of her East Oakland neighborhood and Marin. And she talks about how to strike that delicate balance between keeping your kids safe and letting them experience the world. Lisa joins me, and first she starts off with a scene.
There's one of the parent volunteers. She's wearing Lululemon yoga pants. All the women here are wearing Lululemon yoga pants. We're in Marin, except me. I look terrible in yoga pants. Oh. The parent volunteer's coming towards me down the line. Acorn pouch, acorn pouch. Excuse me, do you have an acorn pouch? Oh, I do, in here somewhere. It's really cute. It's made from fair trade organic cotton. The children sewed them. Wow. My son also does craft projects at his school. They glue things on milk cartons. He's only 5 years old. My son's also five. He sewed your pouch. He did? Oh, he did. Hold it out. That's how we keep things moving.
Hello, Lisa Rothman.
Hello, Hanna Baba.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, so many things to unpack.
Yes,
just in that bit. Tell me, let's just get the origin story. Where did this idea come from?
I got invited to go to that winter solstice carnival in Marin, where I grew up. And so I brought my Oakland-raised children there. Mm-hmm. And what I was struck by was that while Marin is thought of as a very physically safe place, mm-hmm. I was feeling very emotionally unsafe mm-hmm. at the winter solstice carnival. And I was struck by the differences between physical safety and emotional safety and how we can be in places that are physically safe and feel emotionally unsafe, and we can be in places that feel emotionally safe and physically unsafe. Mm. And so I wanted to explore all of that. It really got me thinking about those issues. So that's one of the reasons I did the show.
And that's tricky because, you know, it can get into territorialization and just like different geographies and different abilities to live in different places. And you get into kind of an Oakland versus Marin kind of thing. Were you wary about any of that? Were you like, oh, shoot, I'm getting into some tricky territory. I might need to, you know, be careful or whatever. What were you thinking in going into it?
Yeah, I was terrified. I was terrified for all sorts of reasons. I don't want to reinforce stereotypes. I certainly don't want to reinforce negative stereotypes about Oakland, which is my home and which I love. It's really fraught territory. Part of why I wrote the show is because we are navigating social and economic disparity, vast social and economic disparities here in the Bay Area. And how do we do that? And what does it say based on, and I'm really lucky because also I get to make choices about where I live. And I'm very clear that that's a privilege. And I name that in the show. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think there are lots of assumptions about, oh, well, that place is safe and that place is not safe. And part of what I wanted to say was, well, how are we even defining safety? And who gets to decide what safety is?
Right.
Right?
And so kind of the idea is that you may live in a place where other people might consider it to be unsafe, like Oakland, for example, with high crime rates and like it says here, like you're afraid of bullets, like physical
yes.
harm, whereas you go to Marin and you feel what? What is that that you felt in that line with the acorn pouch? What is that? What is all of that?
Yeah, it was a combination of there were a bunch of rules that were spoken and unspoken, mm-hmm. and I could not decipher what the rules were. So, for example, there was a crystal cave, and children were expected to speak in a whisper, a crystal cave whisper. Mm. And we were shushed because we didn't know you were supposed to speak in a crystal cave whisper. And my child spoke really, you know, like in a normal child voice. Mm-hmm. So there were these, I kept inadvertently breaking all these rules. And of course, I want to fit in. And now I'm exposing my children also because they're being shushed as well. And I'm just scrambling and trying to figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And then there are these really also unspoken rules of there was a seemed to be a dress code. Like you were supposed to show up in Lululemon yoga pants. And I didn't know. I didn't get the memo on that. And so I dressed up for what I thought was in festive attire. And I am the only person dressed up in everyone else, you know, and so they're all, and so I'm not fitting in at all. Mm-hmm. And when we, you know, I want to belong.
Right.
And don't you?
And you want your children to belong.
Of course, I want them to feel like they belong. And when I was growing up in Marin, frequently I didn't feel that I belonged. And I wanted to, and so I went, I thought, oh, this is going to be great. And then all of a sudden, my children were having an experience that was somewhat similar to the experience that I had of not fitting in and not understanding what the rules are. And I'm now in my parent role, I'm not being any help at all to them.
Because that was my next question is, how do you get into all of these characters without mixing them up? I'm always fascinated by that.
It has been a real challenge to differentiate, also because it's a farce. And so that means that instead of any one character having a long monologue, it's a lot of one-liners back and forth between multiple characters. So I do it with voice and I do it with body posture. Mm-hmm. So for instance, the fairy godmother character has a Brooklyn accent and my father character voice is very much, has a lot of nasality. Mm. It's very much a head type
like
voice. Excuse me, why does my daughter insist on living in Oakland? Unlike most of the people in her neighborhood, she has a choice about where she lives. Right. So then, and then we have my husband who just shows up and he's got this really deep voice and he's just happy-go-lucky and he doesn't know that there's this fairy tale world going around. It's, hey, Lisa, how you doing?
He has no idea.
He has no clue. He can't see the fairy godmother character.
It's just you who can see all
exactly.
That.
Exactly.
And the fairy godmother, what does she sound like?
Oh, sweetheart. Mm. Sweetheart. Is anything here in Marin what it appears to be? When the women smile, their eyebrows don't move. Yeah. So she and my father get into it because she has a Wanda in the Woods approach to parenting, trademarked. Her ebook on that title just came out. Whereas my father, Leonard of Belvedere, that's her father, Leonard of Belvedere, he is a caution at all costs approach to parenting. And so they get into a debate about which is the way to go. Mm. And so I want this to inspire people to think about if you're a parent, well, where do I fall on that spectrum?
Yeah.
And why do I fall there? And where did my parents fall?
As parents, we often doubt ourselves, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And this idea of, are they judging me? Am I doing the right thing? Even, you know, where you live, wherever it may be in the world, even for somebody whose family is in another country, for example, for you know, lots of immigrant populations, there's this idea of send them back to learn the language and to, you know, get to know family. But there's a war over there. So it's that safety, balancing that with knowledge. What do you want them to know? What do you want them to gain emotionally? And at what cost? There's so much we're already freaking thinking about that, you know, a play like yours, it feels like helps parents unpack all of those parts of thinking. Is that your goal? Is your goal just to help people think, or do you like have answers?
I want people to be feeling so much compassion for themselves and others about how challenging it is to raise children. Mm-hmm. About how we face really difficult choices every day that we are all, regardless of where we're living and whatever our parenting style is, we are all acting from a place of good intent. And to be curious if somebody is parenting in a way that we wouldn't, to be really curious about the probably very, very good reasons that they are making the choices that they are making.
Lisa Rothman's play is Dragon in the Drop-Off Lane. You can catch it through February 23rd at the Marsh Theater in Berkeley. And if you come to this Saturday's show, I'll be there for a post-show chat live on stage with Lisa. Come say hi. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hena Baba. And now we're going to visit Solano State Prison in Vacaville to the studios of the incarcerated men that we're helping record and edit stories for air here on KALW.
This is Uncuffed.
Stories from Solano State Prison.
Damon Cook is a student in our class at Solano State Prison. He's been incarcerated for 28 years, and recently Damon went up for a parole board hearing, his chance to be released. When the hearing was over, he came straight back to the radio lab. I'll let his fellow producer Brian Thames take it from there.
Damon L. Cook recently attended his 13th Board of Parole hearings. His fellow Uncuffed reporters, Spoon Jackson, Steve Drown, and me, Brian Thames, anxiously awaited his return to interview him about the process and results.
We're trying to figure out how the board went, and from the countenance on his face, it seemed like it might have been positive. I don't know, but I got to...
That's all in your perception. So let's cut right to the chase.
Come on, we want to
know. I received a 3-year denial today. The main factors of my 3-year denial was confidential information from San Quentin. Just people dropping notes. Those notes, they said, are deemed credible at this time. So they used that to base their decision to find me unsuitable.
Are you angry right now?
Actually, I'm not angry, man.
Indifferent? What do you feel?
Disappointment. I feel for my family, not for me. It's really not about me. It's about the work that I put in to get a parole date. They laid out all the criteria and readily admitting I did everything under the sun in prison. Everything bad. 10 years. Nothing. And then some guy drops a note saying that I'm going to kill the population. Just to listen to that. I'm going to kill the population? How does that happen? So this is a method that inmates use, and I'm gonna use convicts, I'm gonna say inmates. Now this is a tool. If I'm jealous or I don't like you, I'll just drop a note saying some things. And then that's what happens. The panel, they hammered me for about 2.5 hours, 3 hours. It seems that distancing myself from my past behavior sometimes can be difficult to people who are in the criminal business. So when they look at me, and when I speak to them, it's a different type of bar, a meter, if I can explain that. And they say, they use words like, oh, you're highly intelligent, you're articulate. These things work to your disadvantage. So the more I hear those, the more I see this hearing's not going the way I want it to go. Even though I try to speak to them in the English that I speak, they still find issues with that. They take issues with that. So they didn't find me suitable, and I'm going to fight. So I'm sitting in the fire right now.
And the one thing that stood out to me more than anything else is your deep love for your family.
Thank you.
What are you going to tell your family about this?
I got to call my mom, but ironically, I got to say grandmother. I don't know if she's going to make it to my next hearing. I don't know. It's a serious situation. I just lost one of my grandmothers, not even 2 months ago. I lost my grandfather. I lost my father. Everybody's gone except for my mother and my grandmother. Part of me wants not to tell them, but I gotta tell them. But right now, I'm avoiding it. I believe this is a part of my journey. But the feelings, man, are there. They're real. It's hard to accept the fact that I've done what I was supposed to do and didn't get granted parole. I don't put it in anyone else's hands. God makes the final decision, and that's the way I believe.
Damon Damon Cook is a producer for Uncuffed, KALW's series at Solano State Prison. He spoke with his fellow producers Spoon Jackson, Steve Drown, and Brian Thames. Brian edited their conversation. Uncuffed is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. All content is approved by an information officer. And you can listen to more stories from Uncuffed at our website, kalw.org/uncuffed. And while you're there, make sure to subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast so you can hear all our stories whenever you want. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Lance Gardner, Priya Mahadevan, True Quinn, and Marissa Ortega-Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Emily Zisman from San Francisco. She'll be playing at the Octopus Literary Salon tomorrow night. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
If I could right all of her wrongs, I would undo all that she did. But you would still look at me sideways, and her apology's not mine to give. If you could only hear me say I love you the way I mean it to be heard, then we could finally lean against each other and never say another painful word. 'Cause I'm a mess when I am with you, and I'm a mess when I'm alone. But at least I am consistent, at least I know what I must own. Please be still, please try.